Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern science and the Genesis record right after this. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for our country. Today, more than half the food that we eat out of our supermarkets is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is being produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbaum of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. And when compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn, which was tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbaum's open pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese, and the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. Now, in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website and download it right there yourself. That's georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page, and you can download that free General Law CD package right there. Hey, we're talking about modern science and the Genesis record, written by a fellow by the name of Harry Rimmer. He's a scientist back in 1945 at 65 years old as I speak. And the content of this book, which is an exploration of the Genesis 1-2 creation account, is 100% true, accurate, and correct, and scientifically verifiable today after 65 years. Now, you've heard me mention this before. How many science books do you know of that are still on the market, still out there, still contain truth? Well, boy, it's not very many. If you take a look in the Louvre, I believe it is, in Paris, they've got the science textbooks over the last 200 or 300 years. And it's quite a story because there's several hundred of them, and they've been collecting them. They have a collection of them there. And they're all out of print. They've all been debunked. All of the scientific discoveries in 1900 that were being taught in our colleges and universities, well, not all, but, you know, the great proportion of them, these books all contain scientific errors. Every one of these science textbooks manufactured by these great universities and espoused and written by these great professors and scientists, they contain scientific error, and so they have to be discarded after about 10 years. There aren't any science textbooks that are out there that have been around for 10 years because our knowledge is being increased so rapidly. You see this in Daniel chapter 12. Knowledge will be increased. 90% of all the scientists that have ever lived in the history of the world are alive and breathing air right now today as I speak. 90%. Knowledge is exploding. And this knowledge explosion, as time progresses along, it contradicts what we thought was knowledge 10, 20, 30 years ago. What we thought was true back in 1930 is as phony as a $3 bill. Now, the Bible hasn't been rewritten. Well, the original hasn't been rewritten. Since 1880, the Bible has been rewritten in the new forms, and as many as 64,000 words have been dropped out of it. The higher critics got hold of it. Yeah, the higher critics. They got hold of the Bible, and they've been editing it, and they've been changing it, and the new versions are about as accurate and just about as scientific as a college textbook from 1920. I would say in polite society, it isn't worth the powder it takes to blow it to hell. Now, that doesn't mean that the truth has been obliterated. The truth is still there. The original scripture is still there. The original scripture still tells us that the earth is a sphere and that it's round. I know religion said that it was flat for a long time, and that discredits the Bible. And the reason for that is you take a guy like Bill Clinton walking out of church on Sunday morning carrying a Bible under his arm, And then you watch Bill Clinton, you know, with his escapades with Monica Lewinsky, and you can see he's a hypocrite. Bill Clinton is like a hillbilly in a whorehouse with a credit card. He's got the morals of an alley cat. And he's president of the United States. And he represents the thinking and the morals of the people of America. They're the ones that voted and put him in there. Which just tells you quite a bit about why it is that the Muslim people around the world hate our guts. It's because we're so immoral, so rotten to the core. And we got that way over a period of time. We weren't always that way. I was talking to a Canadian here recently. He came down here to school, and I said, you know, I really feel bad that we Americans have degraded our credibility with you Canadians. See, it used to be we Americans paid our bills. When we bought something from the Canadians, we paid them for it. Today, we buy a million barrels a day, or maybe it's up to 3 or 4 million barrels of oil a day from the Canadian. And we're giving them worthless paper. We're never going to pay you Canadians for the oil. We're taking your oil, we're making gasoline out of it, and we're burning it up in our cars, and we're never going to pay you for it. And I feel bad about that as an American. I sit here and I say, you know, we weren't like that. We weren't always that way. We're doing that to everybody in the world. We're taking their labor, we're taking their goods and services, and we're never going to pay them. Even if you wanted to pay them, you couldn't. There isn't enough energy in our national body over here to pay off $100 trillion in debt. Now, that's another story for another day, but the reason I bring that to your attention is because while the Bible is true, accurate, and correct, the people who represent the Bible, that is the religious people, the politicians, you know, the people in our society that we trust have lied about it. They have an agenda, and they're trying to influence you. Now, I come along on the scene, and I'm sitting here saying, well, I'm not trying to influence you. I just want to bring the other side of the story to you so you can make an intelligent decision. I think the Bible's been maligned. I think God has been maligned by people, and these people don't have good intentions. And they're called the higher critics. I mentioned that to you last time. And in this story, Harry Rimmer, who takes the biblical side, he's the minority now. You know, we're in the minority. And he says, now, let me explain it to you because it's very explainable and it's very provable in the laboratory. I mean, hell, we can go out here on the street and prove that the Bible is true, accurate, and correct. So in chapter 3, dealing with the second day in the Mosaic account of creation, it contains many amazing scientific truths which Moses could not possibly have known from his personal observation. In the very nature of the case, we have a tremendous argument for the inspiration of the scripture in this fact. Before certain scientific truths were known to the world of men, ages before the scientific instruments that made their discovery possible were even invented, Moses wrote about those facts into his record with such clarity that his record has never needed any revising. In 3,000 years, nobody's revised Genesis 1 or 2. It says the same thing that it said 3,000 years ago. And it was scientifically accurate 3,000 years ago and set the world on their ear. And it is scientifically accurate today and still sets the world on their ear. And the higher critics claim it's false, claim it's unscientific. You can't believe it. Don't listen to Moses and God in the first and second chapter of Genesis. And I'm sitting here saying, well, why shouldn't we listen to it? Why shouldn't we test it? Why shouldn't we prove all things and hold fast that which is good? Why shouldn't we study the scripture daily to see whether or not it's true or false? The religious guys can't do it because they're liars. They've been lying to us for 100 years or more. And the scientists are lying to us. And the philosophers, of course, they've always been lying to us, but now the scientists have lost their credibility, and especially over this global warming trip. They've sided in, you know, with the politicians to pass this $1 trillion tax increase. That's what that global warming is all about. That's their opening round. Once they get $1 trillion out of us, it'll be 2, 3, 5, 9, or 15. Now, what was the source of Moses' knowledge? It could not have been human wisdom, as no men knew these things to teach them to the writer. Moses, he knew scientific truths. Or at least he wrote about them. But he didn't know anything about microscopes. We don't have any evidence that in his society or his culture he had a microscope and could look at a germ, virus, or bacteria. And yet he wrote about them. Now, isn't that just special? Now, neither could it have been the result of personal research or observation, because no man at that stage of human culture could have possessed either the technique or the instruments of research that would have been indispensable to such discoveries. So if we reject the theory of inspiration in Genesis 1 and 2, what other reasonable explanation do we have to explain this perplexing fact that we have to explain? Now, in the simple language in which this revelation is couched, Moses recounts the entire wonders of this day in these words. It says, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day." So here on the second day, first day, remember, he creates light. Second day comes along, he creates the meteorological phenomenon that we call rain or atmosphere, which is indispensable to our lives. We have to have rain. We have to have water. We have to have an agriculture, a means to support all the people that are here on the planet. And he did that. And this quotation is taken verbatim from the Authorized or King James Version of the Scripture, there being no difference between the wording of this text in that version and in the American Revised Version, except the last sentence. The American Revised Version uses uniformly in the first chapter of Genesis this construction at the end of each day. And there was evening and there was morning a second day. The sense of the two constructions is the same, and each is true to the original Hebrew text. Now, the two distinct acts are being recorded here, two. First, the firmament is made, then that the waters are divided from each other. So let's consider the scientific significance of each of these two statements. Both statements are equally accurate and they are scientifically significant. The firmament was made. It did not just happen to be. And the waters were truly divided from the waters, as there are literally two bodies of water, the terrestrial and the atmospheric. So let's consider the firmament and its origin. Firmament, the atmosphere. The piece of real estate from ground up to the troposphere. That's a big piece of real estate there. It's bigger than the Earth. Its volume is greater. There's more volume in the firmament, in the atmosphere, than there is in the oceans. More cubic miles. Now, that's a fur piece, as they say down here in the Ozarks, you know. And it's full of water. And it was full of water before the flood, and that's why it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. 17% of all of the water on the planet at that time in history was suspended in the firmament. 17%. So if you take 17% of the water that's in the oceans today, take it out of the oceans and put it someplace, what you would then have is a lower ocean level, which would then explain why it is that we have buildings built in 130 feet of water off of Bimini. Cities have been inundated. Just like they're talking about global warming today is going to melt the ice caps and the oceans are going to rise by 3 or 4 feet, maybe 10, I don't know, 3 or 4 anyway. Well, that's already happened. And cities that were built out there on that coastal plain were inundated, and today they're buried. Now, that's an aside from what we're discussing here, but 17% of the water. Now, today, only about 2 or 3% of the water is in the atmosphere, much less than there was prior to Noah's flood. Now, these are scientific facts that we can uncover, that we can take into the laboratory today, and we can test them. The critics never talk about that. Why is it that these critics, when you're talking about a skeleton, for instance, an anthropologist or an archaeologist goes out, he digs around in the dirt, and he comes back, he writes a book, and he tells you about how man evolved. And he evolved from the simple to the complex. He was a little feller, like a chimpanzee, but he got to growing bigger and bigger, and now here we are today, getting bigger and better and stronger and so on. But we, at one time, in 1940, we had a 14-foot skeleton in the Museum of Natural History in Chicago. It disappeared. It doesn't fit the evolutionary theory and philosophy, and so they just take the evidence and throw it away. Why is that? You see, that's hypocrisy. That's an agenda. That doesn't have anything to do with honesty or an examination of the truth or a search after truth or reality. That's an agenda. What we want to do is persuade. What we want to do is convince. So I come along and say, well, why don't we take a look at this and find out, well, what actually happened? You know, there's not very many of us that really want to know the truth anyway. Most people's minds are made up. They've got their own agendas, and they don't want to be corrected. And so I just thought, well, you know, just in case you wanted to know. Now, two distinct acts are recorded here. The first thing we need to understand is that the word firmament appears in the entire Old Testament, in the original Hebrew manuscript, 17 times. 9 of those appearances are in the first chapter of Genesis. There's only one Hebrew word so translated in the entire scripture, and that's the word rakia, R-A-Q-I-A, rakia. It is a word that has provided the modernists with considerable amusement due to their consistent misconstruction of the word. Now, whether this misconstruction and twisting of the meaning is willful and deliberate or merely the result of ignorance, this writer cannot say. But since this school makes such brazen claims for the perfection of its own scholarship, we hesitate to say that they are ignorant of this word and of its meaning. So this leaves the reader to form his own conclusion. The word firmament, the modernist claims, showed that the Hebrew believed that there was a solid, firm sheet of some substantial material spread out between the earth and the sky, and that above this metallic sheet there was stored the rainwater. So the Old Testament says in connection with rain, and the windows of heaven were opened. Well, excuse me. Higher criticism here has an agenda. The scripture doesn't say anything about this metallic sheet of iron or something here that's holding the water up in the air. Excuse me, today you see clouds going overhead, don't you? And when you see a storm come through and you see a flood in a particular area where it rained 15 inches, do you know that water is heavy? It weighs 9 pounds to the gallon. 9 pounds to the gallon. In order to get that volume of water to flood 15 inches deep and then to flood, you know, local communities and so on, it takes a lot of water. It takes a lot of weight. You're moving many millions of tons. Just take Hurricane Katrina as an illustration. That storm contained billions and billions of tons of water, which was lifted up out of the ocean, up into the atmosphere, transported thousands of miles and dumped on Louisiana. I don't know if we call that a miracle or not, but that's quite a work. And that's all accomplished by meteorology, as we call it today. The sun evaporates the water, turns it into vapor, stores it up in the atmosphere, condenses into clouds and rains back down on the earth. That's the firmament. And what in the hell is so difficult to understand about that? But these higher critics come along, and they're hypocrites. They know better than that. And they write books, and they poke fun at, and they ridicule, and make fun of the scripture. Their books in 10 years will be sitting in the Louvre, laughed at and ridiculed as being scientifically inaccurate. And these are the hypocrites that come along and say, but the Bible is scientifically inaccurate. Hell, the Bible hasn't been rewritten in 3,000 years, but every one of their science textbooks has been. Now, who are the hypocrites? Who are the real scientists, and who are the charlatans? Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here, kids. Now, listen to this. Whether this misconstruction and twisting of the meaning is willful or deliberate, or merely the result of ignorance, this writer can't say, but this editor can. I can say it. They're lying hypocrites. Worse than that, they're damn liars. They know the truth. And in the scripture, God identifies them. He says they hold back the truth. They know the truth, but they go out and they teach lies, and they do it intelligently. They do it intentionally. They know what they're doing. They've got an agenda. And deception is the agenda. Now, this shows that the modernists, that Moses also believed in this childish idea of the heavens. He also tells us of this firmament that separates the waters above from the waters below, and it's one of the many ridiculous mistakes in science this writer makes. That's their allegation. Now, any scholar can safely be challenged to prove this silly contention. No evidence has been produced to show that the ancient Hebrews did believe in this kind of foolishness. The charge is manufactured to suit the desire of infidelity, and no proof can be advanced to establish this charge that is so often made. The fact of the matter is that this theory is rather recent, having first been advanced in medieval times, some 25 centuries after the age in which Moses lived. So let's examine this word, firmament, and see how philologically, how wrong these modernists are in their contention. This word in Hebrew, R-A-Q-I-A, comes from a root that means to spread out, and its literal meaning is a limitless expanse. Could any more comprehensive definition of the heavens be given than that? Certainly not in human speech. A limitless expanse is as accurate a description of the majestic vault of sidereal space as human tongue can frame. Now, there are Hebrew poetic expressions concerning the heavens that may have a suggestion of permanency or concrete substance, but the word rakia is never used. For instance, in Exodus chapter 24, verse 10, Moses makes a poetical reference to the heavens as a transparent sapphire, which is a beautiful figure of speech, but it does not use the word for firmament, which lacks any sense of concrete substance. Again, in the 104th Psalm, the writer says in the second verse that God stretched out the heavens like a curtain. Here again, the writer is careful not to use the word firmament, as that would be a violation of any possible meaning of the word rakia. The same thing is seen in Isaiah 40, verse 22, where the heaven is called a curtain, but the word there used is yedia, not rakia. To use the word rakia here would be an unpardonable violation of the rules of the Hebrew language, as the poetic expression of the prophet implies solidity, and which cannot be conveyed by the word firmament. Rakia, or firmament, is never used in a poetical reference in the Hebrew text, because all the possible meanings of the word rakia are nebulous or intangible. Just like, how do you describe water in a cloud? There's millions of tons of water up in the cloud, but they're all suspended in vapor. And yes, the vapor will float in the firmament. Now, just for your information, the word heaven that we see, the English word heaven, has three meanings in Scripture. Go look it up in Strong's Concordance, and I'll show you what they are. First of all, it describes the piece of real estate where the birds fly. That piece of real estate extends up for about 10,000 feet. Maybe some birds can fly up to 15,000 feet. I can't tell you. There might be a condor or something like that floating around in the skies of Bolivia at 15,000 feet. But you know, the first heaven described in the scripture here is a limitation. The second heaven, up above the troposphere, goes out into space, and the astronomers tell us it extends out for billions of light years, which I presume is probably correct. It's a fur piece out there. It's a long ways out. And then there's a third heaven, and that's where God lives. This God that we're talking about here in the Hebrew scriptures lives in a place called the third heaven. So when you get to the other side of space, when you get out past all of the planets and all of the black holes and all of the quasars, all of the other side of the universe, all the galaxies and so on, that's where his house is. That's where he lives. That's where his abode is. So you got three heavens here. Now in the first heaven, where we're talking about meteorology, we're talking about rain, we're talking about how do you water the earth? Where do you store 17% of all the water on the planet? It's up in the atmosphere. It's up in the firmament. This firmament, then, includes the atmosphere and the starry heavens, but not the heaven that is the place of God's habitation. That's referred to in the scriptures as the third heaven, and is somewhat apart from or beyond the sidereal system that contains the stars. This firmament has been a sore puzzle to men of science, and to explain its amazing mysteries and contradictions, the eminent physicist Sir Oliver Lodge postulates the ether of space. This is a firmament indeed, as Lodge says. It is as rigid as steel, yet so nebulous as to offer no resistance to light speeding through its structure, and to offer no impediment to the concrete bodies that pass at incredible velocities through this spatial ether. Now, that's something to be considered. You know, if you take a look at the space in between the moon and the earth, what is that? Hell, we don't know. We call it ether. Well, whether you call it ether or rocia or you call it space or firmament or, you know, don't we have to have some kind of a label to hang on that? It's space. Now, there's space between the earth and the clouds. And the water is evaporated up out of the oceans and it forms into clouds up in the ether of the heaven. Well, heaven. You know, we Englishmen have to have a word to hang on this piece of real estate. You can't see it, hear it, taste it, touch it, or smell it, but it's there and we fly airplanes through it. We call it atmosphere. The Bible calls it firmament. So what the hell's the problem? The problem doesn't lie in truck drivers and housewives. It lies in higher critics. They're the ones that are raising all the bitch. The rest of us down here, we look up and we see the clouds floating through the firmament. So what's the big problem? Oh, you may not know what it is. Like gravity, maybe you can't quantify it or describe it or explain it, but you can sure as hell see it. It's there. You can fly through it. The rain falls through it. The water is suspended in it. Ain't it? So then let's paraphrase this text of Moses by a transliteration in English. And let's see what it reads. It says, "Let there be something nebulous and unlimited spread out between the waters to separate the water from the water." Well, isn't that what we're witnessing here? You've got millions of tons of water in the ocean, and we want to transport those millions of tons of water to Louisiana. So we've got an engine up here called the sun, and then the sun creates heat. The heat evaporates the water. It turns to vapor. It goes up into the nebulous ether of heaven, the firmament. Okay? And there the cloud travels from Africa across the Atlantic Ocean, forms into a hurricane, and rains on Louisiana, causing great flooding and consternation and destruction. And God does that. He's got an engine that does that. Now, remember, God is also the guy that says, "I cause it to rain one place, and I cause it not to rain in another. I'm going to turn your heaven to earth and your earth to, what was it? I'm going to turn your heaven to brass and your earth to iron." I think that's the term that he uses in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. He says he gives us rain in due season. Well, Hurricane Katrina is not rain in due season. That's a punishment. Rain in due season is where you get the proper amount of rain at the right time of year to grow your crops. And that's what rain in due season is. And this rain has to come from the atmosphere. This is what's created now on the second day. As we get into the creation, we've got to have a modality for doing this. This is a creation that was done on the second day. First day, he creates light. Second day comes along, and he creates the water to water the earth. The process, the meteorology, we call it. Now, as this statement We're content to let ignorance laugh, but we'll pause to investigate. Let's us investigate. The reader must know that there is a certain type of mind that finds a peculiar humor in any situation that's too deep for him to understand. And many so-called thinkers have laughed this passage to scorn. The charge is made by this school that Hebrews believed, or at least Moses taught, that they were two bodies of water with the firmament separating them from each other. Now this strikes the freethinker and the modernist as too funny for words. And yet this is exactly what scientific investigation reveals to be the fact. The fact is that the atmosphere, the air, we call it sometimes, the space, the air, between the solid hard earth that you're walking on and the troposphere, which is up there about, I don't know, 100 miles or 50 miles or 80 miles, 100, is it 100,000 feet? I think it's 100,000 feet. Let me just take a look here at 100,000 divided by 5,000. That's up there about 20 miles. And there's a 20-mile space up here that the clouds float in, which is called the firmament in the scripture, and the infidels come wrong over here, and they laugh, and they mock, and they write books, and they say, hey, this guy Moses is nuts, and the Bible is false. Hell, it's just telling you what you're looking at every day. But if the Mosaic statement were not so, where would the earth life exist? For these are the two bodies of water, the upper and the lower. You got the oceans that are down here, which is a solid body of water, and then you've got an ocean of water up in the atmosphere. Now, I don't know how much water is up there in the atmosphere, but it's 2%. It used to be 17. Today it's down to 2. That's all the water that's left up in the atmosphere. So the meteorology changed during Noah's flood. That's why you have rainbows now. A different meteorology today than you had before the flood. Before the flood, they didn't have rainbows. After the flood, now you got rainbows. The rainbow isn't a miracle. It's a scientific phenomenon that we observe when light shines through these water vapors, and it casts a light, colored light, that we call the rainbow. That's pretty scientific, isn't it? Now, if it were not separated, nothing could exist except the fish, and as the fish would soon exhaust the supply of oxygen in the lower body of water, it's doubtful if even they could long exist if the upper body of water was not separated from the lower. The supply of oxygen that's essential for the support of life in the oceans, or whether it's animal on land or human, or fish in the ocean, is in the atmosphere, and without that atmosphere from which the ocean supply of oxygen must be constantly replenished, even the fish would not be able to survive. So this invention is very important for all life on the planet. In the oceans, the water is evaporated up into the atmosphere where it falls down into the water again, and every time a drop of water falls into the ocean, it takes with it a certain amount of oxygen from the atmosphere. This oxygen in the atmosphere is replenished by the plants that are on the planet through the process of photosynthesis. They give off oxygen, we give off carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide that we give off isn't enough. So in order to maintain the world supply of carbon dioxide to support life on the planet, we have volcanoes. Volcanoes are a very important part of the entire process of the life process on the planet that now the global warming advocates are telling us we have to eliminate carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Huh? You're going to what? I mean, these fools should come to us and say, we need to eliminate oxygen from the atmosphere because it causes fires. It does. Do you know that if we could eliminate all oxygen from the atmosphere, we could eliminate all forest fires? But in the process, if we did that, or if we were to limit the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, we would also be doing something else, wouldn't we? We would be creating our own death warrant, wouldn't we? Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here. I'm a little over time. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information, call us here at the law school and ask us, and we'll send it to you. Or you can download it from our website. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, and you can download it directly there off of the archives page. go to the archives page. The sources of information that we use in this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, with that then out of the way, let's go on here with Harry Rimmer. Let me give you a reminder. The book is called Modern Science and the Genesis Record, Science Textbook Describing the Science in the Bible. The Bible is full of science. It is a science book. It's a history book, but it isn't totally history. It isn't totally science. There's a combination of both. It's a prophetic book. It's about one-third prophecy, about one-third writings, and one-third history. Prophecy, history, and writings. And as a part of these writings, about one-third of the Bible, it deals with things like science and scientific principles. And even though your preacher says, well, I can't explain this, well, then he shouldn't be a preacher. He shouldn't be a preacher. He knows or he should have known. And if he doesn't know, then he ought to sit down and shut up. They don't. That's the way they make their living. So they side in with the infidelity and with the philosophers and evolutionists and so on, politicians, because there's money to be made here. There's money to be made by lying to you. I don't make any money by telling you that the scripture is true, accurate, and correct. But these people make money by telling you that it isn't. That's, as an illustration, is global warming. That's a $1 trillion deal that's coming into fore there, or coming to the fore. All right, now the condition of the world when the second day was ushered in must not be forgotten. It was in an aqueous state entirely, as far as its surface was concerned. The atmosphere was purely a cloud of steamy vapor that obscured the heavenly bodies like a thick veil. The very rays of the sun themselves were unable to penetrate this depressing mist, and the pale and ghostly gleam of the first day's light was dimmed as a result of that fog. As yet, there was no land in sight. But the terrain that was so soon to be covered with a verdant carpet of vegetation was now wrapped in a grim blanket of moisture, which was both liquid and solid. Where the fluid waters did not cover the place that was to be the land, the frozen and stony ice prevailed. The vapor touched and clung to the very face of this watery frozen waste, and the waters literally merged with the waters. Now, on this day, in order to provide a space where life could exist on the planet, God divided the waters from the waters. That is, the vast waste of water was divided into two separate bodies, the upper and the lower. Of the lower we need not now speak, as it is visible to the human eye, and all accept its presence and its reality because of the evidence of sight. We sail its surface and fish in its depths. On the floor that contains it we dredge for treasures, and clothed in diving armor we walk in quest of strange adventures. We swim in its invigorating embrace, and by physical reactions we accept the fact that the lower body of water is water indeed. But somehow, however, we fail to realize that the upper body of water is equally as real. In truth, it is as real as the ocean itself. In fact, the firmament contains a veritable ocean in suspension. And if its contents suddenly decided to join the lower ocean from whence it came in creation's week, devastation and total destruction of man and all of his works would be the inevitable result. This ocean of the upper waters contains waves and bounding billows that are tossed about into mighty floods by currents called wind. And like the ocean beneath, it has tides which ebb and flow in irresistible power, governed by the same forces and powers that make possible the tides of the ocean. In that upper ocean, we have now learned to navigate, and our stellar ships must be able to float on its aqueous content, as our ocean liners and our submarine vessels sail on or under the oceans, under our feet. In that upper ocean, birds swim through the atmospheric waters as the fish swim in the oceans, and man has at last learned their art. But our atmospheric ships must be constructed in accordance with the laws of the fluid element that they are designed to navigate in, and when for some reason or other there is insufficient moisture in the atmosphere, these ships have heavy weather and often as not cannot leave the ground. If in the course of an aerial voyage the celestial mariner is shipwrecked, he will sink to the bottom of that upper body of water until he lands with a crash, unless, of course, he has had the wisdom to provide himself with a life preserver in the shape of a parachute. He may then expect to perish without one. What difference is there between the parachute of the aviator and the life preserver of the sailor, except a matter of degree? Each is designed to enable the shipwrecked man to float in a particular sea that he may be navigating. Every peculiar characteristic of the ocean that rests on the surface of the earth may be paralleled in the upper sea that is held in place by the construction of the firmament. In the salt water of the ocean, we find types of life that could not exist anywhere else. And so it is in the waters of the atmosphere. We have thousands of species and varieties which are suited to the environment and to that one environment alone. Now, the ocean has a specific weight and pressure. This pressure increases with the depth until the bottom is reached. Well, in the depths of the ocean, there dwell strange creatures which are designed to withstand the degree of pressure there encountered. And if these creatures are caught and brought up to the surface, they literally explode when that pressure is relieved. Now, a moment's consideration will show why this occurs. Their muscle structure is graduated to the weight of the pressure at the normal depth where they reside. And this is a marvel of engineering skill. If the pressure that they must resist is, let us say, 10,000 pounds per square foot, their muscles are built to thrust at the rate of 10,000 pounds per square foot, and compensation is established. Now, if that pressure is suddenly relieved by bringing the creature forcibly to the surface, where the pressure is only 2,100 pounds to the square foot, the muscle contains and continues to push against this minimum pressure with their established force, and the result is that the creature is literally torn asunder by his own muscular power. We note exactly the same condition in the upper body of water, called the firmament, or the atmosphere, that we see prevailing in the lower ocean. There is a certain weight or pressure there also, and it is heaviest on the bottom of this atmospheric sea, which is, of course, sea level. And at this level, we have an atmospheric pressure of about 14 pounds and 9 ounces per square inch. This means that every square foot of surface at sea level is under a pressure of about 2,100 pounds. So the surface of the Earth must bear a constant weight of approximately 58,611,588,000 pounds per square mile. To make it easier to grasp, let's write it this way. The numerals are 58,611,548,000 pounds per square mile. And every creature that lives on the face of the Earth must be so constructed so as to resist this pressure constantly. Even the tiny gauzy insects of myriad hues must resist with their tiny bodies this pressure of almost 1,500 pounds per square inch. Some of these living creatures have bodies that are a miracle of design and that awaken wonder and awe in the minds of investigators who studies their perfect structures. Now, is this a miracle? Well, to us it would be. I don't know how to make and create the creatures that we see in the oceans. You know, down around the Titanic, there's life forms down there. And the pressure down there is tons per square inch. Now, the same thing applies here on the Earth. The higher up you go, the less the pressure, and the lower down you go, the higher the pressure. And every night on the 6 o'clock news, when your weatherman comes on, he tells you what the atmospheric pressure is. He says the atmospheric pressure is 29.36 or 29.92 or 30.11. And it changes. And that change in the atmospheric pressure causes the wind to blow. It causes just like the tides in the ocean, it causes the atmospheric winds to move the clouds around. And it rains on one place and it doesn't rain on another. The rains come at certain times of the year. You know, the Earth is carefully designed and balanced, and it works. It's a machine, and it works. It works like a shot. The sun is the engine that makes the whole thing run. Without the sun, you wouldn't have the clouds moving about. You wouldn't have the tides. We have a thing called the Japanese Current, and it runs up and down the California coast. And 30 miles inland from the coast, the weather is very constant. It's in the redwood region of Northern California. It has to be that way, or those redwood trees couldn't grow. They don't grow anywhere else in the world except along that coast where you see this atmospheric current called the Japanese Current. And these great forests from Alaska where the spruce trees grow 11 foot on the stump and the redwood trees are 20 or 30 on the stump, they grow there because it doesn't freeze. Palm trees grow in Eureka, California. Eucalyptus trees grow where it doesn't frost. It never freezes there. It's not tropical, but it never freezes. Now, those currents are maintained for and have been for thousands of years so that those trees can grow over thousands of years. Some of them are thousands of years old. And it's been that way, and it has to be maintained that way because of this engine called the firmament, created on the second day. It was an important invention. This guy is a great inventor. And the invention of light is a great invention. And this invention of meteorology, this invention of the firmament, is a great invention. We couldn't live without it. So to make fun of it, you know, to laugh and hoot and holler, to show your stupidity, not just ignorance, stupid. These people suffer from the terminal stupids. And we subscribe to them. All right, now with that out of the way, for the reason then that we're constructed to within a sea level pressure, when we climb a high mountain or with our airships, we navigate too near the surface of this aerial ocean. Headache, dizziness, and distress result. If we go high enough, we become unconscious as the internal pressure of our muscles begins to tear us apart. For just like the fish that normally lives at a low level, if we're taken up where the pressure ceases, we too will destroy ourselves by our own power. Just as the eyes of a deep water cod are the first to pop out when we bring it up to the top of the ocean, so our heads feel that frightful effect of the reduction of the sea level pressure before any other part of the structure suffers. So when you go up to the top of Mount Everest, you got to take oxygen with you. You can't live up there without it. Well, not for very long. There are guys that have climbed it, I guess, without oxygen, but boy, they got to be tough. They got to be trained to do that. When we go out into space, we have to take our atmosphere with us. We have to take our firmament. And we don spacesuits. And we put our oxygen in the spacesuit. We build little space platforms out there, and we live in there. We have to take our firmament with us. We have to take an atmosphere with us. We can't live in outer space. Spirit creatures can. God can live in outer space. He doesn't breathe atmosphere. He doesn't need oxygen. He's a different kind of critter. Carl Sagan used to muse and say, is there life in outer space? Outer space is covered with life. There's billions and billions of these life forms out there. You don't need to wonder, is there life in outer space? Revelation, the scripture tells you, yeah, there's billions of angels. There's archangels. There's angels. There's cherubs. There's seraphim. There's creatures around God's throne. And he describes them. Yeah, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of life forms. Not like us, not physical. We're locked onto planet Earth because we have to have this firmament. We've got to have this atmosphere. And that's what the scripture's all about. The scripture's here to describe and to tell you how this thing works, how this machine was constructed, who constructed it, what he constructed it for, and what your role is on the planet and in the overall scheme of things. Well, I'm out of time, so let me give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and the editorial review. We've been sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And with that, our time is up, and I have to leave it right there, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.